This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. This story is from our episode, The Impact of Isolation. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For years, advocates have been arguing that solitary confinement should be completely banned in the U.S. They say it constitutes cruel and unusual punishment, as described in the Eighth Amendment. But so far, federal courts have not been on their side. They have acknowledged that solitary confinement can cause psychological harm, but have essentially said it doesn't rise to the level of cruel and unusual punishment. But new research on the neurological effects of isolation could tip the balance. Liz Tung reports.
It's a Sunday afternoon, and thousands of neuroscientists are mulling around the San Diego Convention Center. It's day three at the Society for Neuroscience's annual conference, and competition for crowds is fierce. But on this Sunday, one event has clearly grabbed the spotlight, a roundtable called Solitary Confinement, Psychological and Neurobiological Insights into Isolation.
So I'm very happy to see you here. There, isolation is a critical issue in the United States. It's largely invisible.
That's Michael Zygmunt. He's retired now, but spent decades as a neurology researcher and professor at the University of Pittsburgh.
It was actually an amazing experience for us. The room only held 250 people, and people were lined up outside waiting to get in.
It was an improbable turnout for what's kind of been an improbable project. Michael spent most of his multi-decade career studying neurodegeneration caused by Parkinson's. But about 4 years ago, he switched to a new mission, investigating extreme isolation and its effects on the brain, specifically mouse brains, which Michael says a lot of people, especially potential funders, do not seem to get.
I've essentially been told, we're not interested. What you're doing is totally irrelevant to the conditions of solitary confinement. You're studying laboratory animals. We're talking about humans. There's no connection.
Experiments involving mice are often a first step in research. But of course, in this case, there probably will never be human subjects to be experimented on. Most people would never consent to being locked up for years on end so that we could study their brains. Also, this wasn't the kind of research where you could just use brain scans. The experiment required something a little more gruesome.
We're required to take the brains out, and few humans want to donate their brains while they're living.
That's Michael's research partner, Richard Smaney. He's a neuroscientist at Jefferson University in Philadelphia. The two men have known each other for a while, but for Richard, this was not exactly an easy sell.
I had no interest in this.
Michael was persistent. He showed Richard all the research about what the most extreme version of isolation, solitary confinement, does to people psychologically.
I often say that Michael Zygmunt is my social conscience, and his passion really brought me into this, and now we're spending a lot of time doing this.
Since then, it's become something of a passion project for Michael and Richard. They've kept it afloat by working in their spare time and enlisting graduate students for help. Now, 4 years later, they're unveiling the fruits of their labors at the biggest neuroscience conference in the world. And not only that, they're sharing their data with everyone before they've had a chance to publish, which Richard calls
really unusual. You generally don't discuss your results with others ahead of time.
That's partly because researchers want to be completely sure about their findings. But it's also because they don't want some other scientist to swipe their findings before they've had a chance to publish. But in this case, Richard and Michael had decided to make an exception, because even though their work is far from done, what they have found seems urgent.
80,000 people today are sitting in solitary confinement. And if our findings suggest that we are causing a physical problem, I find it sort of really morally repugnant to hold that information, which could be used to alter something negative that we're doing to people.
Because Michael and Richard say that information could help answer the question of whether or not solitary confinement causes irreversible physical damage to the brain. If the answer is yes, it could be the key to changing the court's opinion on solitary confinement, the final puzzle piece that shows it is, in fact, cruel and unusual punishment. Now, I promise we will get to those findings. But first, let's rewind a bit and take a look at what exactly convinced these two neuroscientists, already decades into their careers, to change their professional trajectories in favor of research that you might even call activism. It all started about 7 years ago at a California prison called Pelican Bay.
About 100 demonstrators gathered to show support for inmates at Pelican Bay State Prison. The prison hunger strike is to protest conditions
in the state's employment of a long-term solitary confinement policy.
It was the state's first supermax, which means it used solitary confinement not as a temporary punishment, but basically as their main method of incarceration. For some inmates, that meant years, even decades in solitary. In 2012, one of those inmates, a guy named Todd Ashker, decided to file a lawsuit. So he wrote a letter to the Center for Constitutional Rights, a nonprofit that fights for social change through the courts. His letter arrived on the desk of the group's president, University of Pittsburgh law professor Jules Lobel.
The key thing it said is that we're here on hunger strike and we could really use a lawyer to turn this into a class action. And would you be interested in helping us?
Solitary confinement was an issue that Jules had been working on for years.
And my view then and now is to put people in this situation for any substantial period of time is cruel punishment. It's just, you know, it's a basic assault on human dignity and on the human person.
But that's not how the court saw it. Remember, for them, damage has to be physical to be considered cruel and unusual, which gave Jules and his clients an idea.
Why don't we try to approach this from a neuroscience perspective? Namely, what's the effect of this on a physical organ, namely the brain?
So Jules enlisted a group of neuroscientists as expert witnesses who could testify to the fact that social connection isn't just something we enjoy. It's a basic human need, and depriving people of it can do physical harm. It was the first time this kind of argument had ever been made in a solitary confinement case, and it seems to have had an impact. Shortly after sending the briefs to Pelican Bay's lawyers, Jules got word. They were ready to settle.
Well, a big step toward ending long-term solitary confinement in California's prisons. The state has agreed to end the practice as part of a legal settlement. Some Pelican Bay prisoners sued in 2012, arguing that solitary confinement violates the Eighth Amendment's prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment.
It was a major victory in the legal fight against solitary confinement. But it was also important in another way. It connected like-minded neuroscientists, and it sparked a kind of activist movement among them to use their research as a weapon against solitary confinement. One of those neuroscientists was Michael Zygmunt. So Michael roped in his buddy Richard Smaney, and the two of them launched on this ambitious mouse research project we've been hearing about. Their goal was simple: to document the effects of isolation on the brain in a way that mimics the human experience of solitary confinement. Here's how the experiment works. They take a whole bunch of baby mice and raise them in a fun social environment, complete with toys and other baby mice to play with. Then once they reach adulthood, a portion of the mice, the experimental group, are removed to an isolated tank. The rest of them stay in their little mouse community. They're the control group. After a period of 1 to 3 months, mice from both groups are euthanized and their brains compared under the microscope. Richard and one of his students gave me a look at the slides at his lab in Philadelphia.
So what are we looking at right now?
So this one is a neuron in layer 5 of the motor cortex.
That's Richard's PhD student, Vibal Hung. He's sitting in front of a computer screen, tracing a blown-up version of a single neuron.
So, and you can see here, we can 3D. Rotate it in 3D,
wow.
And that's how we can see all the different processes as you go through, and he can zoom in and out.
So how long will this analysis take?
Probably 2 a day or 3 a day.
And how many are you doing?
Yeah.
So if we have 5 regions of the brain, he has to analyze 500 cells to get one ant. And that's just for one time point. Then if we want to look at 3 months, we have to do that over.
It's painstaking work. But by the fall of 2018, they finished their analyses and were ready to present it. Which leads us back to that big Society for Neuroscience meeting. It was there in this room, packed with 250-plus people, that Richard got up and revealed what they had found.
Which was that in the sensory and motor parts of the cortex of the mouse, 1 month of isolation caused the neurons to shrink by about 20%.
Neurons are basically the building blocks of the brain, and communication between them is how our brains and nervous system function.
So if a cell is smaller, it has less possibilities of interacting with its neighbors.
Which in turn could make brain function worse. More to the point, Richard says it's a real physical defect that's been caused by the isolation.
If we put someone into prison and we took off 20% of their arm and said that's just a natural consequence of you having to be there, people would be outraged and say, you can't do that, that's torture. But if we are putting people into this situation and their neurons, which is a structural part of the brain, are shrinking 20%, you can't see that from the outside.
And even though this was mouse research and the findings are preliminary, it was an argument that won over the crowd at the conference. Michael says at the end, they got a standing ovation from the crowd.
It was really incredible. And it was very clear that we had literally touched a nerve in people who saw that the kind of work that we were doing and that they could, in principle, be doing as well, had some immediate social implications. This was not simply theoretical work, basic science, which maybe in 10 or 20 or 30 years, this is something that could affect humans today.
What is theoretical is how it'll play out as part of a larger legal argument against solitary confinement. For now, the courts don't accept animal research as evidence for effects on humans, but Michael and Richard are hoping that'll change.